my overall position, though, is if the voters want to do away with the death penalty, that it should be in their hands to do that. If they do away with it, then this office will deal with that in terms of seeking life without the possibility of parole. But in the last few years, it's been on the ballot, and it's still here.
L.A. County D.A. Jackie Lacey speaking with us last year about her stance on the death penalty. It's one of the issues in the contentious race between Lacey and the two candidates challenging her from the left. Today, we have the first of three profiles, beginning with Lacey. First, though, the CDC is warning Americans to prepare for the coronavirus. It's not a question of if, they say, but when the virus spreads to communities here. Officials say they don't know yet whether it will be a mild or a severe outbreak. There are 80,000 cases worldwide now with outbreaks all over in South Korea, Iran, Italy. We'll talk about the global economic impact in a minute. First, though, a fact check with Lena Sun, health reporter at The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, public health officials here in the U.S. are warning of an inevitable spread of this virus. The World Health Organization says there are just 53 cases in the U.S., most of which came from people traveling abroad. So why do health officials say the spread is inevitable?
They're looking at the very rapid rise in cases in the last several days in countries that have not had the virus before, Iran, Italy. Huge spike in cases in South Korea, mostly through a church that was sort of cult-like, and it was spreading quickly. Japan, the number of cases has gone up. I believe I saw there was a first case in Austria. And it's mostly not just the rise in cases, but the cases for which they don't know how the person got sick. So it's one thing if you got sick because you traveled to China or the epicenter of the outbreak in Hubei province or Wuhan, the city. It's another if you got it because you were in close contact with your husband or wife who is sick. But increasingly, there are cases that are happening in places outside of China where they don't know how the case began. And that suggests that the infection is spreading sort of stealthily, undetected, because many people have mild illness. You may not realize you're sick. You may not realize you have this because it looks like the flu or a cold, and you spread it to someone else. So that is one reason why the CDC has been, you know, with a very very big change in tone, yeah, what they said today.
Right. So should Americans be alarmed? The CDC did say that daily life may be disrupted. So how worried should we be?
Well, there's always the thing like, you know, don't panic, and versus you do need to sort of think about this. Today, the CDC official who gave the briefing, Nancy Messonnier, she's the top person overseeing the coronavirus response. She was speaking from prepared remarks, so this was not off the cuff. And I think they wanted to send a message to let everybody start thinking about if this thing explodes here and is bad, two big ifs, right? Well, they do say it's going to happen here, but how bad and when are the two big unknowns? You should be thinking about this as part of your preparedness anyway. Like if you have to go without childcare, what would you do? And to check with your school about what their plans are if there is widespread. Because once cases become much more common in a community, then it becomes very hard for public health to sort of stop the spread, you know, to do the tracing and figure out how you got it from somebody else, because it's not practical. Then they start to go to what they call mitigation. And mitigation really means how can we make sure to treat the people who are the sickest and make sure our hospitals are staffed in such a way that we take care of those who are the sickest. If you just have a mild illness, then those people should stay home. But if you're going to be under quarantine for 14 days and you have to stay home, then you might want to think about, do you have all your heart medication?
Yeah.
Do you have enough food? If not, maybe a neighbor or somebody else could bring it by. Sort of down the road kind of planning that you have to do. And if it becomes really bad, then they would cancel, you know, large gatherings of people, social events.
Right. Well, it bears stating that the mortality rate is still low compared to other diseases, right? You're not going to die if you get it.
Right, exactly. And it's important for people to realize that 80% of the people who get this illness have mild illness. 20% have severe illness. And when we worry about the people who die, most of the deaths have been in China. Most of them have been in older people, and most of them have been in people with underlying medical conditions. So if you're 88 and you have heart disease and COPD, you are at much greater risk than a healthy 30 or 40-year-old.
All right, Lena, I know you're on deadline, so I'll let you go. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's Lena Sun, health reporter at The Washington Post. I want to bring in Clayton Dubie now, director of USC's U.S.-China Institute. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Well, the Dow is off hundreds of points. Markets are down worldwide. What are investors worried about when it comes to this coronavirus?
Well, first of all, if you have something like this that has such a big immediate impact on China's economy, there are going to be spillover effects. China is the world's second largest economy, and it's been the biggest source of global growth for the last decade. And as a consequence, you know, anything that has such a big impact there is going to have spillover.
Okay, so who is most at risk of being affected in terms of sectors and companies?
Yeah, in terms of sectors, you've got Wuhan, the place that's most affected. It isn't a tech giant, but there are manufacturers there that are important for the tech industry more generally. The problem is that basically much of China has been shut down for quite some time, and so that's going to impact supply chains, and it's obviously going to impact companies that manufacture smartphones. 80% of the world's smartphones come from China. A large portion of tablets and computers generally come from China. And so if you're in that sector, you're definitely going to, you know, see an impact on arrivals of goods and things like that. Not to mention, again, if you're a company that's been dependent, such as Apple, on growth in the China market, you're going to be impacted. Apple had several quarters of declining revenues in China. Just in the fall, it spiked back up, but now basically most of the stores have closed, and those that are open, you don't have a lot of shoppers going in, that sort of thing. So a lot of companies are going to be impacted, including drug companies. We get, you know, most of the drugs consumed in this country are generics. Many of them come to us from India, but many of those Indian manufacturers rely on active ingredients that come from China, and that's going to be, you know, interrupted. So supply chains of all sorts, auto parts, brakes, auto glass, all kinds of things are being disrupted by the shutdown.
Wow. So this sounds pretty widespread, but also how long could this last?
Well, Lena would probably be better to answer that question than I. My expectation, based on the SARS experience and how other outbreaks in China have progressed, is that in March you're going to see quite a fall off, and you know, with the change in weather and all sorts of other things, you'll see a leveling out and a decline in the number of cases. And so hopefully factories outside that main area will increasingly come online. One of the things that happened is because of the timing of this outbreak, although it was known about in 2019, in December, it wasn't so clear and wasn't so well understood until more than a month later. And by that time, so many workers had gone home because China essentially shuts down for a week. And so what this means is that they were home when people got worried. And so getting your full crew back to a assembly line is going to be hard. You may have plenty of people who do part A of the job, but you need somebody who does part B.
Right.
And that sort of thing.
So, but what about, I know your specialty is China, but this is rippling out to the entire world. And I guess I'm wondering if this could have a longer lasting impact because it is worldwide, this virus, a longer lasting business impact.
Well, there are people who are worried about a worldwide global coronavirus recession. And I don't know that that's warranted. It's definitely going to have a large impact in the short term. And for businesses that can't whatever it is they're trying to sell, that disappears right now. If you're an airline, if you're a hotel, if you're somebody, you know, providing travel services, things like that, you don't have that inventory anymore. It is gone. You'll never have it back. But for most folks, you know, the supply chains will recover and the store shelves will be restocked and all of that kind of thing will happen. But you can still expect that, again, in China, with China at the center, but also the United States and everybody else who's connected to China, especially countries like South Korea, Australia, you're going to see an impact. Global growth will be influenced by this. Is it going to be devastating? It's hard to imagine that. But definitely there's an impact.
Clayton Dubey, director of the U.S.-China Institute at USC. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, is LADA Jackie Lacey progressive enough to be reelected? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A week from today, it is Super Tuesday. And yeah, lots of focus on the Democratic presidential primary. But another race on the ballot here in LA is getting some national attention, and that is the DA's race. Over the next 3 days, we're going to profile all three candidates in that race and examine their records, beginning today with the incumbent, Jackie Lacey. Rafe Sun and Shine joins me now. He's executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Hi, Rafe.
Good to be with you, Madeline.
Good to have you. Well, I spoke with her about a week and a half ago, and I asked her about her challengers, George Gascon and Rachel Rossi, and she described a national movement to take out incumbent DAs and replace them with more progressive DAs. And I asked her if she thought that was a bad thing, and here's her response.
I think it's a good thing to be progressive, but I also think it's a good thing to keep the public safety in mind. I'm progressive. I'm just, my attitude is, though, I care about the safety of the community, and I think it's important that when you implement progressive ideas, that they be ideas that are well thought out and well implemented so that you don't have people hurt or don't have the safety of your community deteriorate.
So, Rafe, what do you make of that? She's obviously trying to thread a needle here, walk a line.
Well, this is the needle that a lot of Democratic prosecutors around the country are facing. It's the same problem that Kamala Harris had as Attorney General. The issue has really moved since they were both elected to public office against great odds. Harris was elected Attorney General in 2010. And in 2012, Lacey was elected district attorney. And in both cases, African-American women winning elections in California, which has often been a law and order state, hostile to minority district attorneys, was really quite an achievement. But now the issue has just moved, and they have found themselves a little bit stranded in the middle between the hardcore law and order constituencies and a growing progressive community on criminal justice issues that has indeed been looking at district attorneys.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that Senator Harris has endorsed George Gascon, Lacey's rival in this race.
Yeah, and the endorsements are kind of all over the place. Maxine Waters has endorsed Gascon, and Lacey has the vast share of other local elected officials and a number of state elected officials, including Mayor Garcetti and a lot of city council members and county supervisors. She has a lot of support from law enforcement unions, and progressive philanthropists are supporting Gascon, largely from the Bay Area. But activist groups are strongly in his camp. I think it's even money who's going to win. I don't think she's certainly going to lose. I think even in the African-American community, there's a big generational change and discussion about criminal justice. And I imagine her base is still quite strong with older African-American voters, but on perilous ground with younger African-American and other younger voters.
And so why is that? Why do younger voters not like her record?
Well, I think it's the growth of movements in criminal justice that just accelerated so quickly that it was even hard to see it coming. I think the growth of Black Lives Matter is reflected in a survey we did at the Pat Brennan Institute in L.A. County that found that the most concerned about law enforcement issues were young African-American women voters. It wasn't young African-American men. It was young African-American women, many of whom have been moved or involved in these reform efforts. This issue has really moved, and it has developed a pretty big base of support. However, there's still a lot of support for traditional law and order politics, even in liberal Southern California.
Right. And so she has made moves in the past few weeks to move to the left, right? She's dismissed
yes.
tens of thousands of marijuana convictions. She filed charges against Harvey Weinstein. Is that an effort to is she realizing that she's in trouble politically, or are these actual heartfelt beliefs that she holds on these issues?
Well, I've learned in politics to never distinguish between those two. I don't think I'm all that adept at knowing what's inside somebody's heart. But when you're the incumbent, you do have the opportunity to change the narrative because of your ability to take public policy positions. I'd say the first one on the convictions for marijuana, it will be very popular, and it will help her. I would say the history of DA races in California, though, in L.A., is that celebrity trials cut both ways. She's a mm-hmm. terrific prosecutor. One of her greatest skills is in the courtroom, maybe not always in the political arena, but in the courtroom. But these celebrity trials can backfire. And a number of DAs have hoped for big success with celebrity trials and ended up when it didn't go the way they had hoped it had gone. There's quite a bit of a backlash. But I think she has to adapt. I think she has to find a way to get out of where she's been, but do it in a genuine way and move forward in a genuine way. She can't just turn into something that she's not. She's still very well regarded in law enforcement circles, and that's not going to change. But she has to make her case to a new constituency.
Well, she's certainly making the case that she has created a pathway for nonviolent offenders to get treatment for mental illness,
yes.
to create this diversion program. How successful has that been?
I think that has made a dent. I think it has made an impact. I think it's her signature achievement outside the courtroom. And I think she has needed some things beyond being a good prosecutor. I think where she's run into a lot of trouble is in holding what would be considered misbehaving police officers or deputies accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And she even ran into trouble with the chief of police of L.A. On a very well-known case where he recommended the prosecution of an officer and she did not carry it through, and he has now endorsed former LAPD officer George Gascon. So that question about prosecutorial discretion is still probably one of the sorest points for those who are challenging her. But I do think the mental health area, and also in increasing the diversity in the district attorney's office, where I think she's done a very good job.
Right. And so, you know, just wondering in a bigger picture, you mentioned that there's a split between older and younger African-American voters. When you look at Jackie Lacey and her career, and as you say, it was quite an achievement to be elected in 2012 as L.A. County's first African-American DA, first woman DA. Has she been able to heal any of the longstanding rifts between the police and the African-American community here in Los Angeles?
I'd be hard-pressed to say that a lot of that has changed. I think, if nothing else, her political success is a statement that these offices do not have to be held by white men of a conservative bent, but that they can be open to other people. And I think in her mind, probably her ability to do her job as a professional makes a very important statement for kind of community relations with the police. But nowadays it goes beyond that. A lot of it has to do with events that people can see on video and in other ways where people can draw their own conclusions. And I think she's catching up to that, but I think that has been a challenge.
Rafe Sonnenschein is executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Rafe, thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, growing up in rural Oregon in the 1970s, New York Times writer Nicholas Kristof saw families struggle, but there was a path forward.
Things were pretty screwed up then, too. But at least there was a hope. There was a sense that things were moving in the right direction. And that hope has kind of trickled away, frankly.
How America failed the working class. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Bram. As a kid, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof spent many mornings riding the number 6 bus to school. He grew up in a small town about an hour's drive from Portland, Oregon, called Yamhill. At the time, it was the kind of town that could launch a family into the middle class. There were good-paying jobs, decent schools, strong social networks of churches and community groups holding Yamhill together. But just a few decades later, the Yamhill of Kristof's childhood looks depressingly different. About a quarter of the kids who rode that number 6 school bus with Kristof each morning, well, a quarter of them are now dead, many from so-called diseases of despair, like alcoholism, drug abuse, obesity. Yamhill and the many struggling towns across America just like it are the subject of Nicholas Kristof and his wife Cheryl Wu Dunn's new book. It's called Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. And the Pulitzer Prize-winning couple joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. All right, so you focus a lot on two families in particular, the Knapps and the Greens families. You knew quite personally, Nick, and I want to start with the Knapps. You open the book with a really harrowing scene with Dee Knapp, the mom, hiding in her own yard because her husband is drunk and is shooting at her after he had already physically abused her. Why did you choose that as your opener to the book?
Well, partly, look, the Knapps got on the school bus after me every day. They were our neighbors, and much of the book explores the ways in which everything went wrong after that. And so 4 of the 5 Knapp kids are now gone. Gary Knapp shooting at his wife, Dee, as she lay cowering in the grass outside their home, was a good reminder of, you know, things were pretty screwed up then, too. But at least there was a hope. There was a sense that things were moving in the right direction. And kids, when they got on the number 6 bus, they had that hope. And that hope has kind of trickled away, frankly.
So, yeah, they had hope that those kids would be would do better than the parents. But as you say, 4 of the 5 ended up dying young. The fifth didn't die because he was in prison. Right? The 3 credits that, for his survival?
That's right. So, yeah, Farland was my classmate, and he was a very smart and capable kid. He was fired from his job, went into a downhill spiral, abused drugs and alcohol, died of liver failure as a result. His brother Zeelan died in a house fire when he was passed out drunk. His brother Nathan blew himself up cooking meth. Their sister Regina died of hepatitis from injecting drugs, and the only survivor was Keelan because he was spending 13 years in the state penitentiary. And when, you know, penitentiary is what rescues you, that's pretty tough.
Yeah. Interestingly, a lot of these deaths, I mean, you could say, a lot of people do say, are self-inflicted. At what point do you say, okay, well, there's personal choice here?
You know, this is the most troubling narrative that we have right now and that has governed the way a lot of the country thinks for the past few decades. And it says that basically if you dig yourself into a rut, you have to get yourself out, lift yourself up by the bootstraps. Well, they neglect to say that picking yourself up by the bootstraps is impossible physically. Mm-hmm. It just defies the laws of physics. It's just a nomenclature that gets us thinking on the wrong track. But of course, Farlan, he dropped out of high school and he should not have made that decision. And of course, he should not have taken drugs. Those are bad decisions. But we give people second chances all the time, especially those at the very top. You know, your company fails, we give you a second chance. We give you a third chance. We like when your company fails because you've learned something from it. Well, why is it that when people who are poor fail, we don't give them a second chance?
Can I add something about another of our classmates who we talk about, Clayton mm-hmm. Green?
Yeah.
So, you know, Clayton was a good friend of mine and a very talented mechanic. He was kicked out of school in the ninth grade for fighting, and the school saw him as a troublemaker. So he never took high school chemistry. He turned out to be a very good chemist because he became one of the first people in the area to cook meth. We as a society spent a ton of money incarcerating Clayton and his friends and dealing with the criminal justice and drug consequences, public health consequences of that. We would have been so much better off trying to keep Clayton in school and giving him an education so that he could have become a pharmacist or a chemist for a company or whatever it may be. And so, you know, of course he made mistakes and did dumb things, and he would have acknowledged that. But we also have to look at our own responsibility for putting kids on trajectories in which they make dumb decisions.
Mm. So we're talking about a quarter or so of the kids on your bus. Would you say that that can then be expanded to say about a quarter of Yamhill is not doing well or is prematurely dead?
So, I mean, I'd say that my bus did rather worse than a lot of other areas in Yamhill because of the neighborhoods that it went through. But on the other hand, there are an awful lot of others who survived but are not doing well. So, I mean, they're the two kids who I walk down to the bus with every day are both alive, but one is serving a life sentence in prison and the other is homeless in the nearby county park. So there, you know, there are an awful lot who have survived but are struggling and are imposing costs on all society.
We also went to other parts of the country, mm-hmm. And, you know, because we saw that this is not just a phenomenon happening in Yamhill. And the most compelling statistics are those compiled by two economists at Princeton, Angus Deaton and Ann Case, and they looked at census data, and they discovered that, you know, life expectancy, you know, is just a march upward. We're living longer here in the U.S. and in most Americans and also in Europe and in Canada, except for one group of society, and that's basically the working class. You know, actually, life expectancy is declining. Mortality rates are rising for that group so much so that for the past 3 out of 4 years, those deaths of despair from alcohol-related diseases, from, you know, drug overdoses, and from suicides, they are overwhelming the average lifespan for Americans so that in the past 3 out of 4 years, life expectancy has declined. We haven't seen that for 100 years since the pandemic flu in 1918.
So you say that we should look to perhaps the Soviet Union's collapse and what happened there because you see some similar trends, dwindling life expectancy, malaise, a lot of substance abuse in the form of alcohol. Obviously, Soviet Union was a massive empire like ours, but there were crucial differences, obviously, economically and socially. But do you think that America should look towards that and be worried?
So, look, the differences are enormous, and the Soviet economy was a mess while the American economy as a whole is doing incredibly well. But where the Soviets, I think, made a mistake was they saw these problems, alcoholism, declining life expectancy, and their response was to stop publishing mortality data. They didn't address the underlying causes. And likewise, you know, in America right now, we have so many Americans around the country in distress. You have 68,000 Americans dying of overdoses alone. And I don't think we fully appreciate the degree to which our record suicide rates are all symptoms of this deeper malaise, this frustration. What is kind of a great depression in parts of America, but it's a demographic depression rooted in the working class, even as the first class cabin is having a great party.
Yeah. So what do people who still live in Yamhill and who are struggling to survive and maybe knew the same people that you knew who ended up dying prematurely, what do they say about this? Do they agree that this is a societal problem? Do they blame themselves? Do they blame the people who died for engaging in risky behavior? How do they view this?
Well, I think the people that we talk to, they don't think of it in terms of global or national scales. They're focused really on their own situation. And a lot of them do tend to blame themselves. It's part of this whole narrative of personal responsibility that, you know, they, you know, should have taken responsibility and they made mistakes. And they don't recognize that actually they had so many cards stacked against them from the very beginning. You know, one of the people that we talk about, Drew, it was the son of a friend of ours who worked on the family farm, very bright man who also died of, you know, long disease related to his drug abuse. And then Drew started using drugs when he was 12, and his son Ashton was born with, you know, drugs in his system. So we were worried that it was being, you know, passed on to the next generation. And, you know, he's gone through therapy. He's, you know, got drug treatment, and he was blaming himself. It's my fault. But, you know, he's actually emerging from that partly because he got help, mm-hmm. recognizing that he can't do it by himself and he needed help. And that's what I think is really important for people to recognize, that you can get help and actually there's nothing wrong with it. And if it puts you in a better situation, then you can become a much better productive member of society.
Right. But there's just not a lot of help being offered is basically what's happening.
Yeah. Look, if you think about how we treat drugs, so, you know, for 50 years in the U.S., our basic go-to response has been to lock people up, including users. And, you know, in fact, it's far more effective to provide treatment, to provide medical treatment, psychosocial support, and yet only 1 in 10 Americans with a substance abuse problem gets treatment, even though it pays for itself by some studies 12 times over. And that's, I think, one example of the many, many ways in which so many needy Americans, and kids above all, don't get the support that they need.
So many of the same people you follow in this book are strong supporters of President Trump's. And what you've just described is something that he and fellow Republicans target in their budgets, to cut social services like this, treatment programs. So how do they explain their support for President Trump?
I would just say that, you know, I think a lot of Democrats write off the white working class as inevitable Trump voters. And I don't think that's quite right. On social issues, the working class voters tend to be deeply conservative. So if they, in their voting booth, if they're thinking about abortion, about judges, then they will probably vote for President Trump. If they're thinking about guns and gun policy, they will vote for President Trump. But on economic issues, they're actually much more liberal. So if they're thinking about minimum wage increases, they're more likely to vote Democratic. If they're thinking about parental leave program, if they're thinking about Medicaid or in general access to health care, they're more likely to vote for Democratic. And so I really hope that Democrats in the race for both the presidency and the Senate, that they make these economic arguments. And they're not going to win every one of these votes, but they can win a number of them.
I just want you to talk a little bit about Farlan Knapp's daughter, Amber. This is your friend who died, his daughter, Amber. She seemed to have a very bright future. She had gotten a white-collar job. She had a couple of kids, stable marriage, and everything looked good for her. But then she tried meth, and that was that.
Yeah, Amber is a real example of how, you know, things can go wrong even when you try and do the right thing. She basically was born in a chaotic household. So from the very start, she had a lot of things going against her. She talks about how in one of the pictures when she was really a young baby of her and the family, in the background there's a plate full of cocaine. So,
wow.
And so she grew up, you know, not liking drugs because she saw what it did to her father. And then what happened was she was doing fine. She had 3 kids, a marriage, everything was going well until her dad died. Her dad died, and he was really sort of a rock in the family. Her sister spiraled out of control and started drinking a lot, and she died at the age of 29 from alcoholism. And then Amber, you know, for the first time at 33 years of age, she tried meth. That was the beginning of the end. She lost her husband. She lost her kids. She ended up in jail. And, you know, she was you know, able to hold on to a job in and out of jail. But then the most recent interaction we had was that she was back in jail again.
Wow. It just shows how thorny this is, how difficult it is. And all the her intent and all her hard work, really no match for maybe inherited addiction, predilection to addiction, her, I don't know, her upbringing. There's so many influences.
She was on a tightrope. You know, she was on a tightrope. And while a lot of Americans are on this nice, broad path, and you're less likely to stumble on that broad path, and if you do, nothing bad happens. Amber was on a greased tightrope with no safety net.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Nick, you went to Harvard. You're obviously a celebrated New York Times columnist. Do you have any survivor's guilt?
Absolutely. I mean, I particularly think about these two kids who walked to school with me every day, Bobby and Mike. And Bobby is serving this life sentence in prison. And Mike, we just sent him a copy of one of the articles about the book to general delivery at the post office. And I think, you know, what if I had been in their house? Their parents were alcoholics, and I don't think there were any kids' books in the house. What if they had been in my house? You know, what the differences would have been. And it's very strange to have these kids that you were close to and, you know, friends with, who were just full of zest in life, and now to see them in these very, very different trajectories.
The book is called Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope, by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. They will be in L.A. on Wednesday to talk about their new book. They'll be at the Eritani Theater in Little Tokyo as part of the library's Aloud Lecture Series. Nick and Cheryl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Thank you.
Coming up, comedian Jeff Garlin is here to talk about why wearing a MAGA hat is a radical act and being mistaken for Harvey Weinstein. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Jeff Garlin, network audiences know him as Patriarch Murray Goldberg on ABC sitcom The Goldbergs. But as you'll hear in his recent Netflix comedy special, he cannot escape his role as Larry David's best friend and manager, Jeff Green, on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Every single day, numerous people come up to me and they say, what's Larry David really like? You know, I recently, we were just filming another season, and I said to Larry, let me ask you a question. Does anyone ever come up to you and go, what's Jeff Garlin really like? And he said, no one's ever done that. That's never happened.
Well, Jeff Garlin is here now to tell us.
Yeah, I literally just this past season we were filming, one day I asked him that. I said, I'm just curious. I go, that's never happened, right? Never happened.
You know, before we started taping this interview, I said, I feel like I know you. And you're like, you don't know me.
Yeah, you don't. I am not. I'm nothing like Jeff Green, and I'm nothing like Murray Goldberg at all. Zero? For both. Yes.
There's not even a little bit?
No. My voice, what I look like, you know, but nope, not at all. Zero.
Speaking of resemblance.
Yes.
That's a joke in episode one of
season
10.
The, you know, let's talk about that for a second.
Okay, let's play a little clip from it and then
we'll
talk about it.
All right.
Who invited you? You pig.
Oh, no, Nancy, that is not Harvey Weinstein. I'm so sorry, Jeff. My sister's from out of town.
Oh.
I'm really sorry.
Oh, my God.
Don't worry. I'm the host of the party.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry.
Yes, I'm not Harvey Weinstein.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Okay.
He looks like Harvey Weinstein. He looks just like him.
What the hell?
Okay. All the time. Women, men, doesn't matter. And suddenly I'm this guy. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Well, I can tell you a few things. Number one,
please do.
No one's ever recognized me for Harvey Weinstein. Larry David said, hey, you mind if we do this? And I got it, you know, especially if I wear a suit, you know, and if I have a little, you know, grub on my face.
We kind of play it up in the episode.
Yeah, we play it up. We make a choice to play it up. However, since that episode, people come up to me in the street and go, hey, Harvey. And I think, why don't you call me Adolf? You know, what's worse than Harvey Weinstein? And I did a movie with him once, and he was the worst person on earth. I just think this is a terrible, horrible human being. And why would you think it's funny that you walk up to me and go, hey, Harvey? But now, wait, I understood why the episode's funny.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm not upset if people come and go, that Harvey Weinstein thing you guys did was funny. But people will come up and go, hey, Harvey, what are you doing here? It's like,
oh,
really?
As a joke.
As a joke. They make a joke. And I'm like,
really think it's...
And I go, you've just proven that you have no skill set as to be funny.
So how did this whole thing come up?
Well, just Larry saying, well, we got this idea. I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
You didn't initially say no. This is too offensive.
No, I by the way, I've been doing a comedy. I'm doing Curb Your Enthusiasm. I would never say the words, no, this is too offensive. I'm all good for it.
Okay, I want to play another scene from that same episode.
Okay.
It's pretty on target politically.
What the f*** is going on with you?
What are you talking about?
You're wearing a MAGA hat at a sushi restaurant? Is it true?
Well, I did have the hat on, yeah.
What, are you pro-Trump?
No, no. Look, I got this idea to wear that hat so I wouldn't have to have lunch with Phil Rosenthal, and it worked like a charm. He saw me in the hat and he left the restaurant. It was amazing. And
I'm not surprised.
You know what? It's really coming in handy.
Yeah, because no one's going to want to be anywhere near you.
Exactly. It's a great people repellent.
So Trump actually tweeted that scene.
He tweeted
a different scene.
A different scene with a biker who was angry at Larry, and Larry put the hat on, and the biker said, be on your way.
That's right.
That is Los Angeles. Los Angeles is not a place to walk around with a MAGA.
No,
I have friends that are pro-Trump, and I don't hate them, and I respect them on many levels, and I think they're intelligent. I don't agree. But in L.A., if you were to wear a MAGA hat, even to like just a restaurant, you would get so many dirty looks. You will.
Especially because this is such a show that's set on the west side of L.A.
Right,
it's
yes.
Like a very
Our show is very
demographic.
West. Yeah, it was completely, you know, right on the money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So who came up with that one?
Larry David. Larry. If you love the show, Larry David. If you hate the show, Larry David. So my job as an actor on the show is to tell the story that Larry David wants to tell.
So when you started this whole thing with him,
did
you think that would be such a phenomenon, such a thing, a long-lasting thing?
So for not even season one, we did an hour special. You know, when we were filming it, Larry said to me, wouldn't this be great to do as a series? I said, yes, but my inner monologue was, right, yeah, that'll be the next series that I do. Little did I know. But we did what we thought was funny.
Even as you're cringing.
I'm never cringing.
As like an when we're audience doing, member, oh, I am you, cringing
you, yeah,
all the
I
time.
Know, I hear that. Literally, we'll be filming the worst thing you can think of. And I'll be thinking, I wonder what's for lunch. Always. Or can someone get me an iced tea or craft service? I swear.
Okay, let's talk about you and your wife on the show.
Yeah.
Susie.
Yeah.
She's very crass.
Yes.
You spend most of your time trying not to anger her.
Yes, I would avoid it at all costs.
I'm going to play a clip of tape that is pretty, I don't know, frank and offensive of her.
Boy, what are you feeding this animal?
What do you mean?
Fat as a house. My God, look at the size of him.
What kind of thing is that to say, Larry? You're going to hurt his feelings.
Oh, yeah, he knows what I'm talking about.
He does. He knows. You don't call a dog fat.
You go around calling Jeff a fat.
Jeff is a fat. Oscar's just big boned.
Okay, so she has said that the actress Susie Essman has said that she's uncomfortable making fat jokes about you.
Well,
you are very frank about talking about your struggle with weight.
Yes.
In real life.
But I'm being paid a lot. The show is pretend. Susie's one of my best friends. And I'm like, let it rip. But I've lost enough weight. Well, we don't do fat jokes on the show anymore.
You look really good.
Thank you. There's really, I'm trying to think if we ever have her. She ever calls me a fat anymore. She doesn't. And I've always known if I don't want that to happen, lose weight. That's what I did.
But it was hard for you.
Yes, it's very hard. But I have a unique way of losing weight. Well, first off, I avoid sweets. But as far as everything else, I don't pay attention. You know what I do pay attention to? When I have feelings, I sit with them. That's my diet plan. So when I feel bad, as opposed to eating something, I will sit in my living room, stare at the ceiling, and feel like crap. Yep. And I lost 75 pounds doing it that way.
Really?
So is it hard? Yes. But the feelings are temporary. Are they 5 minutes? Are they 5 hours? Are they 5 days? Generally not more than that unless there's a tragedy of some sort. But what I'm not going to do is when I feel bad or good, have a cookie, have some ice cream. Not going to happen. Hasn't happened in 2.5 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So how did you arrive at that?
I meditate. I do transcendental meditation. I've been to Overeaters Anonymous. Actually, I had a moment. My mom was dying. This was 2.5 years ago. I'm in Chicago, and she's not dying yet, so I'm going to go home for a while. So when I fly from Chicago to Los Angeles, it was always on Virgin, and they always have the Dean and DeLuca Swedish fish, which I loved, mm-hmm. and I would buy a bunch of crap at the airport, and I'd load up. Well, this particular flight, I was listening to this music very intently, and the music I was listening to, the night before, I had been in Chicago at a blues club, and Lurie Bell is who I saw, and he's a guy who had, what's it called when you kind of lose your mind?
An epiphany.
No,
a breakdown.
Losing your mind. No. Now we're on a game show. I so apologize.
A psychic break.
No, when someone is actually mentally ill and they need medication.
Schizophrenic.
There you go. See?
We got there.
So I found out he was schizophrenic, and this company, Delmark Records, said, Larry, we want you to get healthy. We're going to take care of you. And then when you get it together with your medication and everything, we want you to record an album for us. That was the album I was listening to.
Okay.
It's very important because we're getting there, okay. I swear. So we land, and I hadn't eaten any fish, and I hadn't eaten any of my crap. And I went, what's going on? How did this happen? And the next morning, I knew I wasn't cocky enough to go, oh, I got this down. I went to an OA meeting, first thing.
Overeaters Anonymous?
Overeaters Anonymous, yep. And I...
Was this the first time you went to
OA? No, I've been, but I hadn't been for a long time. I never had a sponsor. I got a sponsor. And I just began to believe in a higher power. So later that day, I called my ex and I told her, we're definitely not staying together. And then I had a friend that I had feelings for, but nothing had ever happened, you know. But I said, same day, said, we have to stop our friendship. I just think it's healthier right now. And then I got a phone call that my mom died. All in this one day.
Wow.
Then I remembered that night I had a stand-up set. So I do the set. I don't talk about my mom. Don't talk about what happened. I just went off on some other stuff. It was magical. Driving home, I put on that music that I got, Lurie Bell. And the song, the last song on the album, is a song called Faith in Music. And he says, he's singing, that all he has in the world is his faith in a higher power and music. And I thought to myself, what do I have? All I have is my faith and my comedy, the joy it brings me. So that was the day where it all came together, and I've been sober since then.
You call not overeating or obsessively eating sober, being sober?
Yes. For me, that's sobriety because I never had a problem. I stopped drinking at 20. Now, I've had a few beers since then, but I'm okay. I'm happy as can be. I'm with you. Madeline, how are you?
Your photography.
Yes.
When did you start taking
pictures? 11 years
ago.
Well, not seriously. I never, like, you know, you do it more and more. And I got into Leica cameras, which, by the way, it's at the Leica gallery, but I pay full price for all my Leica gear. I want to make that official. But I love it because of the simplicity and the quiet. You know, my head is, I have a large head and I'm famous. Therefore, I kind of don't want to be noticed mm-hmm. when I'm with a camera. So I don't want to add anything, you know, big. And then I'm on the set with these people. Like, I'm on the set all day with Larry David. I have my camera all day. Therefore, he's completely comfortable with me taking pictures of him.
So you take pictures candid on set?
On set, when I do a talk show, uh-huh. behind the scenes on, like, Curb and the Goldbergs. And then also behind the scenes at Largo, where I perform all the time with all the different comedians.
And what do you want to get with your pictures? Like, what do you want to capture?
I only shoot for joy. I don't shoot with any purpose whatsoever.
Do you shoot on film or digital?
I shoot on film and digital. Oh. I shoot both. I wanted to be a street photographer. I wanted to like do that on the side. But unfortunately, as I said, my head is large and some people, quite a few people will recognize me on the street. Ruins it. Just takes it away.
Well, it's a totally different thing than what you normally do, right?
So I thought to myself, what do I do? Well, I'm just taking natural shots. I don't crop them. I don't use special light. I'm on set, and I just do it out of joy. That's the exact way I approach stand-up. Exactly the same.
But is it a different feeling for you to be quiet and not the center of attention?
No, I'm really comfortable with that. I like that.
All right, check it out. Jeff Garlin.
And this is the last week at the Leica Gallery. It closes March 2nd. This Saturday, I give a tour every Saturday at 1 at the gallery of my work. And I talk about the pictures
and
I answer questions.
Saturday.
I'll be here this Saturday at 1.
All right. Yeah. Check it out. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you!
All right. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast. Listen whenever you want. Maybe you want to listen to Jeff all over again. You can do that. KCRW.com/pressplay. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.